thank you so much for coming. You know, it's been a couple of years since we've been in Costa Mesa. We love coming here. I mean, it's 72 degrees and beautiful all the time, but that's not the excuse why we come. You know, we come because, you know, the people here are really fabulous. You know, I'm thinking of clients that I'm looking at that I've known for, you know, decades. I'm looking at one right now, and we've had people who flew in, and we've known them for decades as well. Some of you, this may be the first time you've heard Dave talk. You're in for a treat. I saw a portion of this presentation a couple of weeks ago. I know Dave has updated it, but in Seattle, I think you'll find that this is a very fresh presentation. For those of you who listen to the weekly commentary, you're going to be familiar with some of this material, but there's a lot of new charts and things to actually visually look at that you can't look at in the commentary. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Dave, but I want to let you know beforehand that we consider you family. I've been with the McIlvaney family for close to 30 years. I came to work with Don, David's dad, in 1987, and it's been an honor and a privilege to work with the family. Many of you work with other people back at the office, men and women, actually, who've been there for 20, 25, 30, 35 years. We have very little turnover in the company because when the Lord leads us there, we realize this is truly a calling. So thank you for coming, and let's go ahead and hear it for David McIlvaney.
Well, welcome. I'm glad to be here with you tonight. I want to share with you some thoughts about where we're at today in 2016 and some of the transitions that we see developing. And when we look at the world, we tend to do so from sort of a multidisciplinary perspective. We're very interested in politics. We're very interested in geopolitics. We're also interested in economics and finance. And those are areas all which we'll see some highlights tonight. And I would suggest to you that some of the things that we are in the midst of witnessing are unique enough to be game-changing, absolutely game-changing, financially, either positive or negative. It could be devastating. It could be one of the greatest windfalls in your life. From a political standpoint, there's a lot to gain. There's a lot to lose. There's many things that are in transition that we literally in a generation or two have not seen change. 2 weeks ago, when we were in Seattle, less than 48 hours had passed since the Brexit vote, and we ended a 43-year commitment to being a part of the EU, or the United Kingdom did. And now they'll go through a 2-year process of change. I don't know that it'll be a bad thing for the UK. In fact, I have my own opinion, which we can get into in a few minutes. But there is change nonetheless, and I think we'll see radical transitions not only in the EU, as we have seen some change here initially in the UK, but likely the same kinds of monumental shifts here in the United States and in Asia and in other places as well. Rutger Dornbusch, who is a contemporary economist, says that in economics, things take longer to happen than you think they will. And then they happen faster than you thought they could. And that echoes Lenin from many years ago. There are decades where nothing happens. And then there are weeks where decades happen. It's one of my favorite quotes because one of the things that you find is that crisis is an element that compresses time. Crisis compresses time. And what ordinarily would take months, years, or decades can happen literally overnight. I'm going to suggest that the number of things that are in transition is not only astounding, but that the speed with which we will see change in the next 2 to 4 years will even be more astounding. So the areas that we'll consider tonight just is sort of an overview. The political, cultural change, populism, and the influence of technology. Geopolitics will divide into sort of two different areas, hot and cold. Areas where we think that there's less likely to be real conflict we'll define as cold, and areas where we think there is more likelihood for conflict, war, loss of life, we would put that in the hot category. And then we'll wrap up with a summary of the transitions that we see in the stock market, the bond market, and last but not least, precious metals. So there's some common denominators. When you look at the countries where there is a growing sense of populism and an unsettledness with the status quo, and those common denominators have to do with weak economic variables. We look and say, you know, it's no surprise, actually, that Britain left the EU. If you look at a chart of their current account deficit, It has been steadily growing, and the last count was at 5.2% of GDP, which is a record. It's the highest or the largest current account deficit that the Brits have had since they've kept record going back to 1948. When you look at what is happening in the UK, you see similar echoes to that with the Five Star Movement in Italy, with the National Front, with Le Pen in France, with Podemos in Spain, with Syriza in Greece. And I would suggest that we see the same kind of thing here with Trump and Sanders, that contrast, what we saw in the early part of the election season, representative of an unsettledness in the body politic. And what you see is all of these political movements expressing discontent with the status quo. They're fighting establishment trends. They're fighting establishment parties. They're fighting established power structures. And you see, again, an expression of unsettledness or discontent in each of these areas. Now, one of the things that we think will change politics and culture rapidly is what technology does, both in the area of financial technology. We're watching that happen very quickly, where banks are having to reconsider what they do, how they operate. Should they even have branch banking any longer? As we move more and more towards a digital age, what is the use of having tellers and people that you have live contact with walking into an actual store? So you look at the real estate investments of most of these banks and the vast networks of branches, and it almost looks irrelevant in the digital age. Well, how do you capture the new era of banking? That's on the table. We see it not only influencing the area of finance and banking, but when you look back to what happened with the Arab Spring, you had information change hands at such a rapid pace, places to gather, things to do. People are going to do X, Y, and Z, and we need your help right now. A popular uprising which upset a political regime which could not be upset for better than 30 years. And it was enabled by technology. It was decentralized communication at its best. Decentralized communication. Keep in mind what has dominated the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even through the 90s was, in many cases, state-sponsored or state-controlled media. Or very connected and limited media outlets, where you might say they're all owned by the same corporations, or just two or three corporations, where you can kind of expect that the news flow is going to look pretty similar. Having the means of communication be decentralized or alternative is a significant game changer. It's a very significant game changer. And it's one of those things that influences the pace of change in the future. Alternative media, I mean, of course, many of you know the weekly commentary that we do. We've done that now for 8 years. Every week, Kevin and I have done that. And we've endeavored to have guests that will bring insight into particular topics where we feel that we need someone's expertise added to the conversation. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for turning over every rock, every stone, to find the relevant data that helps us make wise decisions as we counsel you or manage assets for your benefit. And we would not have that if it wasn't for technology. Doing it as a podcast as opposed to traditional radio. I talked to many of the people who were in radio for years. When we were in Seattle, one of the gentlemen that joined us for dinner was Frosty Fowler, 65 years experience as a radio talk show host. And that media is radically changing. It is radically changing. Talk shows were something that existed through the 80s, 90s, and even in the last 5 or 10 years, we've seen radical shifts. And the venue is changing. But what I'm suggesting is that that represents a loss of power. It represents a loss of power for those who like to convey a particular message through traditional media. It means that they have new competition. And that competition means that there is greater conflict between, if you want to put it in the broad categories of us and them, it's really the politically connected and the moneyed elite and the media elite with what they would consider the hoi polloi, what they would consider people who don't brandish the appropriate pedigrees. If you really wanted to be in traditional media, what should you do? You should go to journalism school. You should write for the New York Times. You should cut your teeth at a legitimate place like that. Listen, I would bet that everyone in this room reads blogs and has access to online materials that are of use to you weekly? Is it fair to say daily? Some days, even on an hourly basis? I mean, is there information that you're gathering today that 10 years ago you wouldn't have had access to because the medium has changed? I mean, I turned off my smartphone because there's 1,000 things that will either tell me someone's sending me a message or, the news feeds that I regularly get from BBC and Bloomberg and whatnot. And so I would suggest to you that alternative media, pace of change, decentralized communication, you're going to see more volatility over the next 24, 36, 48 months than you could have ever imagined. And a part of that is tech-enabled. But what is behind it? What is behind it is a massive amount of discontent with the status quo. As we said, the common denominator for that discontent is that as the world has tried to be, sort of put back together in the post-global financial crisis world, the benefits have not been distributed equally. And everyone in the UK who is in the middle class, everyone in Italy who is struggling to keep a job in the middle class, everyone in France, Spain, Greece, here in the United States, Asia is no different. If you're in the middle class and you're feeling a squeeze, you're a part of that group that says, it's not quite working for me. Ian McCavity, a very good friend of our family, unfortunately passed away this last March, not long after we had an interview with him on the Weekly Commentary, like to say that when times get tough, economic nationalism and protectionism tends to rise because it's always easier to blame someone else for self-inflicted problems. And it rings true when you have unsustainable fiscal and unsustainable monetary policies, which are a source of instability in themselves. Politicians will rarely say, I'll be the person who takes the hit. I'm to blame. That was my idea. I apologize. Why are they so reticent to do that? Well, they know that they'll have to face the music. They know that that's the end of their political career. And we don't have people who go into politics for short, temporary stints. They go in and they intend to stay forever. So deflecting blame to someone else, finding a scapegoat, one of the things that I think you'll have to appreciate and represents a massive transition in 2016 is that we are moving towards greater degrees of global conflict. Why? Because you're dealing with domestic economic issues which no politician is willing to take responsibility for. And to the degree that a politician won't take responsibility for domestic economic issues, guess where they will go playing the blame game? You can go north, you can go south, you can go east, you can go west. But it's not going to be on your home territory. Maybe we blame an influx of Mexicans. Maybe we blame being flooded with natural resources from Canada. Maybe we blame being flooded with product from China. And maybe our response is to slap on huge tariffs to steel that's coming into the United States from China. We did that this year. Massive tariffs on Chinese steel. And so whatever the issue is, politicians will deflect, defer, and blame. And it opens up the possibility for pretty significant conflict from a geopolitical standpoint. We've had the fruits of globalization, the benefits of globalization over the last 20 to 30 years, where we've seen a greater interdependence and increased connectivity between countries at every level. It's now when you see domestic politics moving center stage that international politics suffers. In domestic politics, that's what defines Syriza. Domestic politics is what defines the National Front. Domestic politics is what defined Brexit. And all of a sudden, these foregone conclusions in terms of normal international relations, they're being changed because of a catering to domestic politics. You have a rise in populist politics. And of course, what we've said and what I'm arguing for is that the rise in populist politics has everything to do with dissatisfaction with the domestic economy. And wherever and whenever there is dissatisfaction with the domestic economy, it's almost axiomatic that you begin to see a concern with immigration. It becomes a hot button issue. And you've seen this in almost every time period through history. What we saw as a massive purge in Germany under Hitler started as a very frail economy, not being able to do well, still dealing with the pressure of the Treaty of Versailles, and a very just inability to get above those economic and financial commitments. And what began to happen is immigration, as it was occurring, they did a very good job. The Jews did a very good job of integrating into German culture. The problem was they integrated so well that you saw them taking the top posts at universities, you saw them taking the top posts in banking, you saw them taking the top posts in almost every, you know, law, very bright people, and this was deeply resented. But it was really resented, really, really resented, because the economy was already frail. So you had domestic economic issues, which made immigration very much a hot button issue in that time frame, and I would argue in almost every time frame since, before and since. It becomes an issue when the domestic economy is not healthy. The geopolitical issues are arising at the same time, and they're arising at the same time that we're seeing credit growth slowing. And this is, I think, a critical point to make. We've had global credit and domestic credit growing it at an unprecedented scale, and that has supported a massive amount of the globalization trend that we've seen over the last 30, 40, even 50 years. But when you begin to see credit contract instead of expand, again, you end up with countries turning and becoming much more insular, becoming much more concerned with what slice of the pie they're going to maintain. If you can imagine an enormous pie as the global economy, and it's divided up amongst all your major players, if that pie is not growing, then the only way to create growth is to steal a part of the pie right next to you. And so that, in effect, is what is happening. If the global economy will not grow, the only way to grow is very geopolitically contentious. So what we're watching happen in terms of Eurozone disintegration, the UK is certainly a part of that. The UK is, I think, a very small concern. It may have been the first olive out of the jar, but you have many, including Greece, Spain, and Italy, who may vote to leave as well. France is certainly a possibility as well. But when you look at the impact, Greece was a significant issue, and it has been since the summer of 2011. You have Spain and Italy, which are 6 and 9 times larger in terms of an economy than Greece. And to consider them pulling out of the EU would be the end of the project altogether. So Eurozone disintegration, it is likely a cold conflict in the sense that, no, it doesn't immediately lead to war. Whereas the Middle East, the conflagration that we see there, obviously tensions still exist. Syria, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and it's already a hot issue. And we're kind of stoking the flame, so to say. Our foreign policy, we decided to make a pretty dramatic shift away from Saudi Arabia in the last 24 months and towards Iran. And it's changing the nature of relationships all throughout the Middle East. If we are not tightly tied to the Saudis and are in fact making overtures to improve relationships with Iran, what does that mean for Israel? What does that mean for any of the other countries that have relied on this basic source of stability, where we buy oil and are guaranteed a supply of oil from Saudi Arabia? They, on the other hand, have promised for 30 or 40 years to be the buyer of first resort or last resort, depending on how you want to look at it, for our treasury bills. So they will take the petrodollars that they have and recycle it and help fund our deficits. What are we doing, folks? How do you finance your deficit if you're angering the Chinese with what we're doing in, and we'll get to that in a minute, with what we're doing in the South China Sea? And, I mean, maybe we're doing it legitimately, I don't know, in the South China Sea. But we're taking our two greatest creditors, those in the Middle East and China, and we're saying, look, we're going to reshuffle your political deck. We're going to tell you exactly what to do and how to do it. And we're going to tell you who to be friends with in your neighborhood and what exactly that's going to look like. And you're going to be thanking us for it. And you're still going to finance us. And I don't think it goes that smoothly. So what you're seeing is a radical realignment. Russia and China, I mean, they're improving economic ties as we speak. They have 30 different trade deals that are on the table right now. They have a $6.2 billion transit that they're wanting to cooperate, putting in the trade corridor, the new Silk Road, as it were. And you've got Russia, who's looking for a strategic partner to buy $20 billion worth of Rosneft, one of the largest natural gas and oil producers in the world. They produce more oil and natural gas than ExxonMobil. I mean, this is a significant state-owned enterprise, and they're wanting to strike a strategic deal between China and India as well. So, you know, what we're doing in the context of creating what we think is the world that we want is we're creating a tremendous amount of instability. in terms of relationships which have long existed. You know, the last point there, Asia-Pacific, the territorial disputes between China and Japan are on the increase, and China and the Philippines, this is likely a very hot topic and something that I think in the next 3 or 4 years could end up with resorting to military exchange. Has anyone seen the map of China's 9-dash line? 2. Make sure that you look at it when you get home. The 9-dash line is what the Chinese assume is theirs. And what you'll note is what they assume is theirs butts up against what everyone else would naturally assume is theirs. And if you are, for instance, in the Philippines, you assume that the water right off your coast, you have some territorial claim to. But the Chinese would say, no, 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 that's a part of the South China Sea and it's a part of our territory. Even though, again, when you look at the map, you'll see how preposterous the 9-dash line claims are. But this is exactly what is, you know, center stage. The United States is routinely sending carrier groups into the area, and we do that for show of force. The Chinese, on the other hand, feel that they have to, again, show some force and make clear that their claims are legitimate. You've got a case that's being heard in The Hague as we speak, which will determine a conflict between China and the Philippines. And my view is that it's going to favor the Philippines. And the Chinese, from that point forward, are going to get much more aggressive militarily and contest the legitimacy of the court in The Hague, international court. The markets which are in transition, this, I think, we'll look at the global equity markets, the U.S. equity markets, fixed income and precious metals. What we're watching now is, I believe, ushering in the second half of what started in 2008 and 2009. The backdrop for that global financial crisis was a massive amount of debt and was a piece of legislation that should never have been overturned. Is everyone familiar with Glass-Steagall? So it was put in place in the 30s because it was determined that in the 1920s, banks handled themselves with a very low level of ethical perfection. They were scoundrels. They were absolute dirty, stinking rats, and they stole from everyone, and they packaged products that you couldn't believe and sold them as if they were, you know, something perfectly suitable for grandma, when in fact they were toxic. And they did that in the 1920s, and they had their hands slapped in the 1930s, and Glass-Steagall was the primary means of holding Wall Street in check. Because they couldn't govern themselves, they had to be governed externally. If you won't be ruled by the law within, you must be ruled by the law without. And that's what Glass-Steagall did. We repealed that in 1999, and in essence turned Wall Street into a state-sanctioned casino. And all of your big banks, today what they are is casinos. That is what they are. And more problems have come from that change in 1999 from then to now. You look at all the problems that we had in 2005 and 6 with nasty loans, a massive real estate bubble, the financing of which was enabled by very creative financial products that Wall Street put together. Under Glass-Steagall, they couldn't have done what they did. And we've assumed that Dodd-Frank will do something to fix that, and it's not. It does very little to solve the problems that exist because basically you have no one reigning in Wall Street or keeping them from the same casino-like operations that they've been running since 99. The realignment that will happen in the second phase of the global financial crisis, first phase being 2008 and 2009, the second phase of realignment will be much more broadly felt, and I think it'll be in the area of currencies. So a massive global currency realignment. You already see people who today are pouring into safe haven vehicles. Most recently, that's been government bonds and to some degree gold. That traffic has driven yields to record lows. I think investors are going to have to ask themselves a very critical question as we transition from what was a very stable currency environment to what will be a very unstable currency environment. So one of the transitions that we see is people will view global equities differently, will view U.S. equities differently, will view fixed income, regardless of where it is, U.S. or otherwise, differently, and precious metals differently, because we're talking about a denominator issue. What are all these assets denominated in? And what is the real value of the asset? And does it deserve to be marked as if perfect? The BRICS have run into a few issues. I think you know the acronym BRIC stands for Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and South Africa. Mm-hmm. And in essence, you're looking at extensions of a Chinese growth story, which are in the process of suffering greatly. That is an extension of the Western debt-driven consumerism story, because we buy the stuff which is manufactured in China, and the natural resources for the manufacturing process are then sourced in various sundry places around the world. And to the degree that the U.S. consumer is not buying the stuff, the rest of the world is feeling the pain. So it is both a Chinese growth story and a Western debt-driven consumerism story. The fascinating element is that the world central banks would like to do one thing. They would like to bring us back to what they consider the great days, the halcyon days of 2004 to 2007, where the consumer knew no restraint and was able to buy and willing to buy anything and everything on credit. And so what they're trying to resurrect is something that was actually not sustainable in the first place. And they're having a pretty hard time doing it. Brazil, as we speak, is heading for depression. If you look at the ETF, which represents their largest companies, down about 83% from the peak. And, you know, to look at some of the other global stock markets, which are in transition. When I think of 2016 as a year in transition, this is a year in transition. Now, I need to repaint this because a week goes by and the Fed intervenes and you go from negative 1% on the S&P and now you're positive 4% for the year. So take the blue line and mark it up a little bit. At the lows, the Shanghai was off 48%. The Shanghai Exchange, the Hang Seng Stock Exchange, was down 35%. The DAX is the German Stock Exchange, down 30%. The Nikkei, down 28%. And again, to the degree that we've seen central bank intervention following Brexit, some of these numbers have improved. You think, well, how is that possible? I mean, economic activity has not improved. There's been no increase in business. If you strip out the Business News Channel cheerleading, we are in a major transition already. You're seeing this led by the most vulnerable markets. And again, there are elements that reflect 2008 and 2009 very well. Actually, let's go back one year further, 2007, because you had a number of economic variables which were already off and beginning to tip over. They were not positive. Things were getting ugly as soon as 2007, and they were ignored because everyone knew that the central banks would back the play. Wall Street was not at risk. Wall Street was not at risk. Why? Because the central banks would back the speculation. And so you had deteriorating fundamentals in 2007, even as stock prices were hitting new highs in 2008. And that's exactly where we're at today. Why do I think 2006 is a transition for the global markets? Because we have deteriorating economic fundamentals, and the central banks are doing a masterful job of covering over that. How long does that last? That's a very good question. But I think 2016 may very well be that year. Looking here in the United States, part of our issue is a composition issue. We've had job growth, but if you look, the red line is your manufacturing jobs. I just wanted to give some perspective in terms of where growth has been and where it's begun to decline over the decades. Your red line is manufacturing jobs, which have really been, you could say, in structural decline since the mid to late 80s. With a lot of that, you know, 90s and the 2000s, we're suffering in terms of being a manufacturing nation. This is all from the Fed, by the way, the St. Louis Fed. The blue line down here at the bottom is your leisure and hospitality, food services and drinking establishments. We have seen a steady increase in jobs there, and we've also seen a pretty significant increase in jobs, not only through the decades, but even since the year 2000. While private sector jobs have not been on the increase, public sector jobs, government jobs have been on the increase. That's the green line. So, you know, when you consider the politics of the day, keep in mind that there is a growing number of people that have a vested interest in the Leviathan, a vested interest in the status quo, and don't really want to see change because they're just fine. I've seen some reports that the average government employee, and this may be inside the Beltway, it would have to be, I would think, receives in remuneration each year greater than $120,000. $120,000. Now, the private sector average is closer to $45,000 or $50,000. There's a big difference, one versus the other. There's also a big difference in terms of sustainability. From December 2009 to December 2015, transition of this year, we had 13.9 million jobs which were created in that time frame, 2009 to 2015, 13.9 million jobs created. We also had 13.56 million jobs that were lost to what is called the no longer in the labor force, or NILF, no longer in the labor force. These are people who've just dropped out. Maybe they've retired. Maybe they've been looking for a job for 3 years and they just decided, We're taking a longer vacation than anticipated. In that same time frame, we've had gross debt rise by over 54%. And I think one of the things that you should reflect on as you see U.S. politics and the themes which we were suggesting earlier in terms of discontent and populism, that kind of populism doesn't support full employment. You know, if we were, in fact, on the cusp of full employment, which you three, you know, being at less than 5%, we're this close to being officially at full employment. In the history of the world, you've never seen populist movements sometimes expressing themselves violently in the context of full employment. When people are happy, they don't care what politicians do. When people are fed, they don't care what politicians do. When people are secure and feel good about tomorrow, they don't care what politicians do. Politicians have free rein in that environment. The fact that there's a discontent, a massive discontent with the RNC and the DNC, I would suggest to you, sheds further light on how farcical the U3 unemployment number is. And so one of the curious things is the Fed themselves decided that U3 was no longer reliable. Did you know this? So they created their own measure, and it's called the Labor Market Conditions Index. The Labor Market's Conditions Index is a composition that for them, again, they'd say U3, that's not the number we can use internally when we're trying to make decisions. And by the way, has U3 improved since the worst of the global financial crisis? Has it come from 10 to 9? We're just talking about the statistic, not necessarily the reality that lies behind it, but 10%, 9%, 8%, we're now at about 5%, right? Just below 5%. Why is it that under Bernanke, he talked about an exit strategy from radical monetary policy and never implemented it? We haven't taken one step towards disengaging from this massive monetary push. We haven't done it. Now under Yellen, the same thing. If we get to this number, we will act. I mean, if this was a credibility thing, these guys and gals have lost so much credibility. But understand that a part of what they're looking at is not just the U3, which is advertised conveniently for the consumer. U3 says all is well. The Labor Market Conditions Index has typically turned down 3 to 12 months prior to any official recession being announced. And it has trended lower for the last 6 months in a row. So in spite of Friday's jobs numbers being somewhat impressive, it doesn't change the Fed's decision about what they do with interest rates because we are already tipping over. This is what a transition looks like. Why is 2016 a year of transitions? Well, without fail, the Labor Market Conditions Index turns over 3 to 6 to 12 months before a recession is announced. If we're on the cusp of announcing a recession, how can they possibly raise rates? They will be accused of what they were accused of in 1937, tightening monetary policy too early, throwing us back into, and it's one of the reasons why the Depression lingered so long, and stock market participants didn't recover their full value until 1953. Was because the Fed started to tighten market conditions in 1937. See, you've got students of the Fed who do look at that history and say, look, we don't want to be held responsible for extending or reintroducing the second leg of the global financial crisis. We've got to accommodate. We've got to keep rates low. We can't raise rates. I know we promised we would. We said we would if we got to these numbers, and we've gotten to those numbers. But I'm telling you, this is the behind the doors conversation piece. And I will tell you, this is exactly what a transition looks like. Looking at how the S&P has grown, this is a picture of the S&P. What it is adjusted for inflation. So if you take the Fed's target of, say, 2% a year, whatever the actual CPI has been through the years, and apply it to the increases and the declines in the S&P, what you'll notice is that by the time you get to 2016, and we're setting new nominal highs in the S&P and the Dow, circa 2014, 2015, 2016, we haven't made any real progress to speak of at all, adjusted for inflation. We are, I believe, at an inflection point, and I think the trillions in stimulus that we've seen since the end of QE, which was in the fall of 2014, those gains have pretty well been capped. Again, just for a little bit broader reach, the green is the Dow, the blue line is the S&P and the NASDAQ. All of these are adjusted for inflation. And if you look, you only have one that's above the zero line going back to the year 2000. You've got the Dow, which is up about 10% since the year 2000, adjusted for inflation. Folks, when you're investing money, you need to know what your real rate of return is. Your real rate of return is minus inflation, And to take it one step further, of course, you should also factor in the taxes that you pay. But just taking out inflation, the Dow hasn't gone anywhere. The S&P hasn't gone anywhere. For all the fuss and fancy of trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars spent, we're not making any progress, with the NASDAQ still down about a third from its peak levels. Borrowed money is what drives the stock market. And again, I think we're at an inflection point. I think this is what a transition looks like. The blue line is the S&P 500. The red line is margin debt. It's axiomatic. When wild and crazy and borrowed money chases the market, it goes up. And guess what happens when that wild and crazy and borrowed money has to be paid back? Because it is, after all, a loan. And by the way, brokerage firms love it because you're paying, what, 6, 7, 8% interest on a margin account in a zero interest rate environment? They'll lend you $1 million. Why? Because they can't make 8% anywhere else, 7%, 6%, whatever the rate may be where you're at. But when the money starts to come out, when the leveraged money starts to come out of the market, and actually we could take this goes back to 1995, we could take this back to the turn of the century, and it's the same thing. Leveraged money, borrowed money, drove the stock market bonkers up through 1929. When the plug was pulled on borrowed money, guess what was happening to the stock market? It's the straw that breaks the camel's back. And we've already begun to see some withdrawals from margin levels. By the way, what this does not capture is how it compares to the debt levels that we've seen throughout the decades. Because, I mean, we're talking about numbers here, you know, $400-500 billion, which is obviously far more in borrowed terms than was borrowed in 1929 or the 1930s. But relative to GDP, we're at levels we've never seen. 3% of GDP is borrowed capital in the stock market. Typically, when you get to a 2% threshold, that's when you see a massive sell-off in stocks. So are we on borrowed time? I think we are. And I think this represents a major transition. Margin debt will continue to come down as we head into 2017, if for no other reason than investors have no idea what the next administration will hold. They don't know if either a Republican or a Democrat will be good for the market. It could be unsettling. Because on the one hand, you've got Donald Trump who says, look, we'll just seek debt forgiveness, we'll default, it doesn't matter. I do this for a living, it's no problem. And you've got a feminazi on the, I don't mean to offend, I retract that last statement. You've got a gal who could be very unsettling for the stock market. Probably not unsettling for the bond market in the same way that Trump would be. And think of that. You could have Trump who's very positive for the stock market and negative for the bond market. You could have Hillary who's very negative for the stock market but positive for the bond market. Needless to say, I think the next 6 to 12 months, you're looking at diminished margin exposure and a major bear market in stocks. I think this represents, this is what a transition looks like. Why is 2016 a year of transition? Look, folks, I mean, if you go back to 2007 and 2008, we were hitting highs in terms of the debt that was put into the stock market. If you go back to the year 2000, 2001, not only were we putting in new highs in terms of the stock market, but there was more money borrowed at that point in history than had ever been borrowed. And when margin debt started to be paid back, it was a part of the catalyst, a part of the cascade for lower prices. That's what a transition looks like. We have inventories which are on the rise. We have sales which are on the decline. This is simply a ratio of the inventory to sales numbers. And you'll see that the inventory sales ratio has been increasing. It's been on a negative trend since 2000, let's call it 2012, 2013. It's not a sign of economic strengthening. In fact, it's businesses who are selling less stuff. I mean, that's the reality, is when you have more in inventory and your sales are in decline, you expected you needed to produce X number of widgets and you didn't sell them all. And that carries over into the next year. Well, how many are we going to produce this year? We didn't sell them all. When you're overproducing, this is not positive. Well, you can see we are nearing levels that we were in 2008 and 2009 at the crisis, but we're supposed to believe that all is well. The Dow was up 250 points on Friday, a very impressive 18,146. And you would never know that earnings are already off 31%. Compared to last year, earnings are down 31%. Is that priced into an 18,146 Dow? I don't think so. We've already completed a major corporate profit cycle. Okay? We're on the other side of a major corporate profit cycle. It increases, it increases, it increases, And then it declines and it declines and it declines. And then it increases and it creates. I mean, these things do run in cycles. It's not as if we're talking about the end of the world. We're just talking about mean reversion. We're talking about a transition, which is going to hurt a lot of investors who aren't privy to what a transition looks like. So earnings are telling you that something is wrong, even though the prices of stocks don't factor that in. Why don't the prices of stocks tell you that? Well, buybacks. Are you all familiar with stock buybacks? How that works, what that is? Okay, so in the first quarter, corporations have spent $161 billion buying back their own shares. Now, I mean, you tell me, if you're a person, I try to convey this to my kids, you know, the classic way of making money is buying low and selling high. Dow and the S&P in nominal terms, not adjusted for inflation, but in nominal terms, the Dow and the S&P are at or near all-time highs. Is that the time you want to be buying company shares? I mean, I would think that if you were a treasurer at a company, you know the long-term value of your company, and it gets sold down to pennies, you do everything that you can to retire shares as fast as you can. Now, of course, that would imply that you've put money in the bank and have lots of liquidity to do that, and are not scared, like other shareholders may be, to own your company. Do you believe in the viability of the company? What is happening is a vast fraud, and it is duping the vast majority of investors into thinking that 18,146 means something. I can tell you what it doesn't mean. It does not mean that corporate America is doing well. It means that corporate America has gamed the system by buying back shares and improving their EPS number. Earnings per share, if you take the total number of shares outstanding, okay, total number of shares outstanding, and diminish it, and then divide your revenues by the total number of shares outstanding, you may improve your earnings per share number even as your revenues are in decline. So take IBM as an example. IBM in 2005 had outstanding shares of about 1.6 billion shares. Their share count today is under a billion. It's about 970 million. They've decreased the total number of shares outstanding by 40%. Their revenues are down by 60 or 70% in that same time frame, but you'd never know it by IBM's share price, which is hovering not far from all-time highs. So they've seen their revenues absolutely gutted, but because they diminished the number of shares outstanding, everyone's still happy because they're beating expectations. And they're telling you what to expect as an investor. We expect to earn 3 cents a share. Ah, we made four. We're geniuses. Now, if you look at their revenues and sales, that's where it gets nasty. You have to care more about the details, and not just the details that the news media proffers as the appropriate details to pay attention to. We're in the middle of a transition. We're in the middle of a transition with earnings already down 31% and it not reflected in the share price. We're in the middle of a transition with sales on the decrease and inventories on the increase. By the time it dawns in the general public that there is more hope and hype in the stock market and less real substance, I think the indexes are going to be 30 to 50% lower. I can't tell you enough about the importance of buybacks, because those have been the dominant driver of prices. Those have been the dominant driver of prices. Well, okay. Buybacks, $161 billion. That's in the first quarter of this year. The last time we hit numbers like this were, let's see, the third quarter of 2007. Okay, so when companies can't really do anything else to improve the bottom line, guess what they do? This is just called creative finance. It's creative finance. They're trying to create something that actually doesn't exist, which is the perception that things are getting better and better and better and better. Dow volumes have been falling since the year 2009, even as the price has been rising. Think about that. Can you think about that? Volumes, that is the number of people like you and me who are buying shares in the Dow, that's on the decline, and yet we're seeing a continual increase in the price. Has that happened? Well, buybacks are part of the explanation. Speculative short-term trades, that's certainly a part of it too. But that's what I would define as unhealthy. To see a significant trend. I mean, look, this is your growing volumes, greater participation in the stock market. The average person says yes to mutual funds, says yes to stocks. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, this is 1987 where you see a decline in volumes, okay? But really, since World War II, we've seen a massive increase in volumes. Now we're seeing a major decline in participation. And what it suggests is that smart money already knows that they should be out, and they're getting out. And it's the dumb money, and I say this with all due respect, but this is the way Wall Street views it. The dumb money, they're happy to leave them holding the bag. They're happy to leave them holding the bag. That is the general public. So will Wall Street be okay? Yeah. But this also defines why there's going to be massive amounts of conflict between rich and poor. Because about the time that people who don't have much to retire on are checking their 401k balances and they're down 50%, and yet the smart money was already out. How do you think that plays politically? How do you think that plays politically? Your Occupy Wall Street movement was just a taste. That was just a taste. 2016 represents a year of transitions. This is your Buffett indicator, Warren Buffett's favorite measure of valuation, where you take the value of corporate stocks and divide it by the total size of the economy, or GDP. And the stock market is between 60 and 70% overvalued by Warren Buffett's favorite measure. Now, of course, he makes money on the belief that the economy is fine. So he likes this measure, but he doesn't talk about it anymore. Why doesn't he talk about it? Because if everyone believed that the stock market was overvalued, they might actually sort of tighten their belts, spend less money, get ready for tougher times, and that would not do well for See's Candy, Dexter Shoes, and just about everything else that he owns. So you've got two variables here, right? You've got the value of corporations, the value of corporate equities, and you've got the size of the economy. We're at a level that has the stock market overpriced, but we also are going to watch that other factor change. You've got the Commerce Department, which is in the process of a downward revision for GDP by about 2%. Believe it or not, he ranks the fourth lowest of all presidents in terms of GDP averages. And this is with the Fed providing lots of wind to his back. More trillions created, spent, used in this administration than any other in history. And the best he's been able to average is 1.55% GDP growth on average per year. 1.55. And as I say, the Commerce Department is getting ready to revise official GDP numbers down further by 2%. This is what a transition looks like. Why do I say this is what a transition looks like? Because you go from overvaluation to undervaluation. And that's not a problem if you see transition coming and do something about it. But if it's overvalued and it's undervalued, I mean, this is with our kids, we love to do this. I'll show them this chart and won't tell them anything of what it means. And I'd say, so tell me where you would be a buyer and where you would be a seller. And so I've got a 10-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old. You might have met Tess out front. This is her first business trip. She's very excited. Her first trip with daddy for just exclusive business purposes. And the answer is going to be, well, yeah, this is where you buy. And maybe you buy here. You would buy here, maybe here, maybe here. Well, what about up there? No, you'd be insane to buy up there. Well, that was the year 2000. What about right up there? No, you don't do that. That was 2008. That was 2007. What about right now? Is now a good time to be buying? And again, I don't have to tell them what this is. They'd say, no, you'd be crazy to own it right now. This is a place to sell. There's a better time to buy. There's a better time to buy. And then I could tell them, well, I'm not going to tell them about corporate equities versus GDP or a ratio that obviously that would blow their minds. But I'm telling you, it can be that basic where you say, do you want this right now? Do you want this right now? Is your 401k loaded just with a general exposure to the Dow and the S&P? Is it? Is it? Because if it is, you understand that according to Buffett's indicator, you're 60 to 70% overvalued, and we're in the context of mean reversion. We're there. What's my argument for mean reversion? 31% decline in earnings, is that compelling enough? The end of a profit cycle, is that compelling enough? What do you need to see? The only thing that's really going to motivate you, if you haven't made a change already, is a 20, 30, 40% decline in equities. And then you'll be like, oh, I should have done something sooner. And you'll be selling out at lower levels, which is very typical. Because I do tell my kids this. I'm going to teach you one of the most basic things about investing you can know. Buy low and sell high. But know this too. It's also one of the most difficult things you'll ever learn. Because you're fighting your own psychology. You're fighting being alone and doing something that's unpopular. You're basically choosing to always do what's unpopular. Because when everyone's excited about stocks, you're willing to say you can have them. And when everyone's willing to give them to you for nothing, you're willing to say, thank you very much, I'll take them. You're always acting in the opposite spirit to the general market. And that's difficult. Lower interest rates have also been one of the things that have supported stocks. Green is the S&P at the top of the chart. And blue is your 10-year yield, so your 10-year treasury yield. And the red line at the bottom is your federal funds rate. This flat line that kind of looks like what you see on, you know, some medical sitcom when somebody's dead. That's our Fed funds rate. lowering rates has been a help to the market, and that's always been in reserve. The Federal Reserve always has that in their back pocket. So if there's a stumble in the equity market, they'll lower rates. And it's absolutely what they'll do. They can lower rates and then bring them back up. And then when there's another stumble, you lower rates. Problem is, I think we're at an inflection point in the Dow and the S&P. And as it begins to sell off, guess how much latitude they have? Guess what they have in their back pockets? You get 25 basis points to work with. In theory, they can take rates lower. But I think that's one of the things we're going to be struggling with in the years to come is investor behavior. Savers are not going to like zero forever. And I don't think savers are really going to like negative at all. But I think this is what a transition looks like. We've been topping. We've been stalling. We've done that three times. And I think this is a major super cycle top. We had legitimate economic growth from 1974 to 1999. That's what that looks like. That's what that major move is. 1974 to 1999. And we've been struggling in a very lumpy fashion to say, well, where are we going from here? And the only thing that has helped us put in new highs is monetary policy. That's not the basis of economic growth. It's not. I mean, contrary to what 700 PhDs in economics at the Federal Reserve think, that's not what drives economic growth, monetary accommodation. 10-year government paper, boy. We're looking at the lowest yields in 5,000 years. The lowest yields in 5,000 years. Prior to Brexit, we stood at 1.73. We're at about 1.38. Germany was positive, almost 10 basis points. Now they're negative, almost 20. France was at 45. Now they're at 10. That's an all-time low for the French OATS. OATS is the acronym for their 10-year treasury. Greece is about 7.95, 3% for Portugal, 1 and change for Spain. What's really interesting, think about how dysfunctional this world is. It's argued that the U.S. Treasury market is the safest Treasury market in the world, right? Look at that. How is it that we earn interest of 1.38% if we buy Treasuries, U.S. Treasuries, and we earn less if we invest in Spain or Italy? Is there something dysfunctional about that? Is there something that suggests that this is ultimately not sustainable, that people are not making rational bets? This is what defines one of the largest bubbles in world history. In world history. And think about this. Low rates are generally required to help an economy along, right? They lower rates, and increasing rates are typically reflective of a pretty robust economy. And it's just a question of matching up borrowers and lenders. And so you're incentivizing borrowing with lower and lower rates. That's what they're trying to do, is incentivize more borrowing. And what they're finding is nobody wants to borrow. So what are they doing? They think that they can solve the problem of a lack of borrowers by lowering rates. And guess what's not happening? Borrowers aren't coming to the table. They're frustrated because all their theories are being thrown out. All there, I mean, the central bankers of the world. So if rates are the lowest they've been in 5,000 years, does that imply that the global economy is in a more precarious position than it's been since 3000 BC? Something's very, very unhealthy and very unsustainable here. You've got Japan, which is negative 29 basis points, Britain, which is negative 76 basis points, the Swiss, which are negative 69 basis points. There's 11.7 trillion and counting, dollars that is, of government paper, which today yields less than nothing, where investors are willing to say, look, it's a liquid capital pool. I know I'll get part of my money back, which is good enough. And I might even see currency appreciation, because if there's real concern in the world, guess what's going to happen? People are going to continue to buy this paper, and the yields are going to go lower. And on the other side of the equation, the price is going to go higher, and I'll make money. So you've got people who are speculating at the extreme end of a market, right? The rationale that is going into buying government bonds today is really no... Well, there is. There is a difference between this and, say, the NASDAQ stocks in 1999, because the footprint of central banks is massive in this. You've got the ECB, the BOJ, the People's Bank of China, the Fed. They're crowding out the markets. They're buying everything in an attempt to liquefy banks. But banks won't do what the Fed is assuming, what the PBOC is assuming, what the BOJ is assuming, what the ECB is assuming, what the BOE, the Bank of England, is assuming, which is... if they're liquefied, they'll lend more money. Because guess who's on the other side of the equation? You and me and every other Tom, Dick, and Harry who doesn't want any more debt, doesn't need any more debt, is concerned about paying off the debt that we already have. And yet they're willing to drive this. drive it down our throats. Federal Reserve, there should be no problem lowering interest rates below zero. I guess it's all a matter of perspective. I think this looks a little bit like Ben Bernanke, frankly. Central banker in grade school, in an increasingly complex world, sometimes old questions require new answers. And this is passing for higher math. And if you don't understand it, you're not invited to the table. You clearly didn't get a PhD in economics and clearly wouldn't understand. So I do think that. Doesn't that look a little bit like Ben Bernanke? Bill Gross describes this point of the debt cycle as being something of a supernova. His comment, I think, is apropos because we are at the end of a cycle, a massive credit expansion. And what happens at the end of an expansion, sometimes it's a collapse, bringing in the picture of the supernova. The burst of this particular bubble, I think, will devastate confidence, and burst it will. This is why I get back to the issue of currencies being very critical in the next few years. People are buying government debt, not aware that the classic means of eliminating the pressure of debt is devaluation. And ultimately, what is going to be most appealing to the Spanish, the Italians, the French, to leave the EU is to regain monetary sovereignty and to be able to print away their woes rather than implement austerity. Austerity has been something that's been very politically contentious. Nobody likes it. I mean, for those of you who receive Social Security in the room, don't have to raise hands. This is just a rhetorical exercise. But if I said your Social Security payments need to be cut by 20% to start with, internally, what do you feel? Are you excited about that? Are you thinking to yourself, there's a problem with this? I'm going to have to tighten my belt. I mean, maybe you're going to start making donations to the AARP and sending letters saying, look, you don't let this happen under any circumstances. Well, this is what Europe's been dealing with since 2011. As layer and layer of austerity has been layered onto them, they said, look, you can't have this benefit. You're going to have to actually retire at 47 instead of 32. That's not that bad in Europe, but they're changing expectations. And politicians would much rather not deal with the political ramifications and the unsettledness of a body politic that says, stop squeezing us. And they'd much rather go back to the old-fashioned, look, nobody understands inflation. Nobody gets it. Nobody's going to connect the dots between money printing and the increased cost of goods and services. So let's just get on with it, because the people are too stupid to figure it out. And we'll be out of office, retired, living on the French Riviera long before anyone figures that it was our fault. So that's the way I think they want to go. And I think currencies and currency volatility and a loss of confidence in the area of government bonds ultimately translates into people looking at the denomination differently. Who's the audience for gold? I think you're looking at the future audience of gold. It's the current bond buyer who thinks, I have good reason to be in government paper. Maybe today they do. Maybe for the next 6 to 12 to 18 months they do. But we are at the end of a debt cycle. And at the end of that debt cycle, things tend to turn and go the other direction. If interest rates have come down for 30-odd years, and they're at zero or negative in many cases, and have never been this low in 5,000 years, I mean, this is really not bright at all. Where do you think they're going next? They can either keep them low forever. I guess that is an option. In which case, you've decided that it is appropriate and tenable to have price fixing, because that's essentially what you're doing. When you are determining interest rates at an arbitrarily low number, what are you doing? You're setting a price. And you're now operating against everything that history has taught, which is that price fixing only works for a short period of time until people figure out that it's a game and can be gamed, and it's artificial, and it's not sustainable, and it doesn't represent reality. So my contention is that interest rates cannot be held low forever, because it's no different than fixing a price. And fixing a price has never worked. Never. So 10 trillion, now 11.7, and growing, of negative yielding government bonds, that's Danish, that's Swedish, that's ECB, Swiss, Japanese, we're still positive yields. People look at the U.S. Treasury market and say, well, gosh, you guys are high yield these days. These are the lowest rates in 5,000 years, and that's supported by other research done by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. And if you're going to take rates negative, guess what comes with it? A corralling of investors. If I'm going to say, Richard, you're stuck with $100,000 in this bank, and at the end of a one-year term, you can have $99,000 back, and you're going to be happy with this. And you're going to say, well, maybe I'm happy with it, but maybe I'm not. What are my other options? The best thing that I can do is tell you you don't have any options and you're just going to get used to it. And the way that you do that is by moving to a cashless society, because the opt-out mechanism for a negative interest rate environment is holding physical notes. 12 months ago, I read an article by a hedge fund manager in London, and he said, gosh, you know, if this trend continues, I could make more money buying euros, the physical currency, and storing them in a warehouse than keeping a euro-denominated deposit. It's a guaranteed loss, or at least I know exactly what I have, and I can calculate my insurance and storage fees. And I'd be better off paying the insurance and storage fees than having my wings clipped by the central bank. So you know that amongst hedge fund managers, and certainly amongst individuals who don't like having their wings clipped any more than a hedge fund manager does, that behavior is, wait a minute, no thank you. Which means that the necessary prerequisite to implementation or the permanent implementation of price controls as it relates to money is a cashless society. So we either go back to a free market where prices are set by buyers and sellers, in which case interest rates increase, or they never increase again, and we are stuck with a cashless society. That is a very scary reality. For some, maybe we're already there. But negative rates, yes, they change the behavior of individuals and institutions. Yes, they encourage hoarding of capital outside the system. And the answer is very simple. You put a wall around the financial system and don't let anyone out. Does that sound odd? This is not a pet idea of mine. Ken Rogoff publishes a book in August with a sort of a popular argument and appeal for this. He's been writing articles in the Financial Times. He's been writing articles in Foreign Affairs Magazine and maybe the New York Times too. I've got to remember where I saw his stuff. He wrote some articles also for the Bureau of Economic Analysis saying this is why we need to go to an entirely credit and debit system, get rid of cash altogether. Don't you know the amount of criminal activity that's supported by the exchange of bills? I mean, so there is sort of this, don't you know, the criminality involved. And so it'll just make it a safer world for all of us. And I mean, you know, you're a law-abiding citizen. What do you care if we move to a cashless society? Or are you? Oh, you have some interest in us not being in a cashless society? Why? What interests are you protecting? What are you hiding from the government? It's this strange logic of we just don't like being corralled that somehow the folks back in Washington don't get. They don't get. And I think this is one of the things that you could say is positive relating to sort of the political volatility that lies ahead, because there is a group of people, common men and women, who say, I don't think you understand what we're going through. I don't think you understand what our concerns are. I don't think you see what we care about. And unless you get on board with what we consider important, you're out. And I hope that's 535 people that are out. Lose a few good ones, but the vast majority I think we could do without. It's not just Ken Rogoff, it's also Michael Woodford at Columbia University in his book, Interest in Prices. Please don't order it and please don't read it. It's about 800 pages, and unless you're an insomniac, it's a bad idea. But he builds a structural case. It's a neo-Keynesian, neo-Wixilian economic model in which he says, we're going to redefine the natural rate of interest, and it's going to be negative. And on that basis, the central banks can engineer every kind or any kind of economic growth possible. It's a very fascinating thing, but I'm telling you, this is Ivy League, and this is what will be influencing policies over the next couple of years. Look for Rogoff's book in August, and like when you travel on a plane, you might want to carry one of those neat little bags with you while you're reading it, because I think you'll find it to be interesting and somewhat upsetting. How much is too much in terms of debt? I think the problem with too much debt speaks for itself, but when there are multiples of debt compared to global economic activity, it's difficult to generate growth. So you've got to have the ability to continue to make payments on that debt. Does that make sense? And if you don't have enough cash flow to make payments on that debt, then it's just unsustainable. It's like the guy riding along with the elephant on his back. At a certain point, I'd like to know who manufactured those tires. That's impressive. That's where my money's going. But that's the issue, is that interest servicing sucks away resources that otherwise could be put into investment and put into things that generate economic growth, that generate long-term sustainable jobs and increases to income. Debt is the number one reason the global economy is sluggish. Why? Because there's too much of it. And there's not enough activity to now keep in touch with the amount that was already there. And the governments of the world are just layering on more and more on top of it. It's dangerous. It's dangerous. The resolution that politicians are seeking is now involved in the political process, and they're determined to choose winners and losers and decide who's going to take the hit. Negative rates makes all of us take the hit. to a certain degree. Why? Because it represents a tax on all liquidity flows through the economy. If it is stagnant and not moving, they're going to tax it. How do they tax it? By applying a negative rate to a deposit. That's a political choice. That's choosing winners and losers. This is what $1 million looks like stacked in $100 bills. Just for reference, $1 billion on 10 pallets. These are $100 bills, roughly 5 feet high, with a little extra left over for the love seat. And our debts, unfortunately, I can't keep up with this. 6 months ago, it was $18.5 trillion. Now it's 19.3. And by the end of the Obama administration, it'll be at $20 trillion. So you've got the Statue of Liberty down there, a couple of tractor trailers. And if you look very closely at the bottom, you can see your original billion with the gal sitting on the love seat. You look close. But that's current liabilities. If you want to throw in unfunded liabilities, it's a totally different thing. Here's something to remember, because we can afford this debt. Interest rates have to be low. If they let go of the market, if they let interest rates return to a natural level, which was Newt Wicksell's idea back in the 1880s, said any time you hold rates too low for too long, they will go higher than you expected them to be. And so this is where Woodford comes along and says, look, we can take Wicksell's ideas and figure out how to engineer keeping them too low forever and never let them go higher, ever. So it's kind of a bastardized version of Wicksell, but that's, I mean, if you look at his book, that is exactly what it is. It's neo-Keynesian, neo-Wicksellian, and he's saying, look, we don't have to be afraid of this. You can triple this. Make it $100 trillion. Who cares? Because if we take rates negative, I mean, it's just not a problem. It's not a problem. The key is how much of your total tax revenue is directed to interest payments. How much of your total tax revenue is directed to interest payments? From a fiscal standpoint, debt becomes an impossible burden if the percentage of tax revenue dedicated to that one line item grows too big. 9 to 15% is probably tolerable, but rising to, say, a 20 or 30% level, again, relative to what the government is seeing in terms of tax revenues, not tenable, not tenable. Now, this is not real debt. This is debt along with the obligations that we've made, be it Social Security. These are all your unfunded liabilities. $210 trillion is the amount that Boston University professor Larry Kotlikoff says over the next 20 years we accumulate because we don't have enough tax revenue and we're going to be running in deficit each year. So, you know, it's like moving to Detroit on a national scale. When Detroit was growing, it was one of the most prosperous cities in the world. Remember? I mean, this was the home of the automobile, and everybody wanted an American automobile. And they grew their liability structure in line with one of the most prosperous cities in the world. And then guess what happened? Changes began to happen. Manufacturing from the Japanese improved. Manufacturing from all over the world. We began to have an appetite for something other than U.S. autos. And what happened to Detroit? The economy shrunk, but the liabilities, what had been promised out, was already on a massive scale. On a massive scale. It was one of the wealthiest cities in the world. And the liability structure represents that. That's what we're talking about, is Detroit on a national scale. Pilgrim's Progress, this is from Pilgrim's Progress. And, you know, the theme, both in that book, and I think it's a strong literary thematic, just suggests that carrying burdens through life is not what you want. And you certainly don't want to be the person or the generation that is the creator of the burden. Having inherited burdens, if you ever have, you know that's not something you want to leave behind. Ethically, you know that there's something that rubs you the wrong way about that. Fundamentals have completely disconnected. I mean, what we've been discussing tonight is how prices are so radically different than an underlying economic reality. And this is it. Fundamentals have disconnected from asset prices, primarily because of central bank monetary policies, and they are running out of steam. What do you do for an encore? We're now experimenting with something that's never been done in the history of the world, negative rates. Never been done. I mean, we can hope that it turns out all right. But you can already tell by what they have to do to creatively solve the human problem, which is people don't like accepting an automatic and guaranteed loss. They have to move to control. Not only are they going to control the rate, but they're going to control you so they can continue to control the rate. How long does that work before you bounce into a 1776 or a 1796? Before people are fed up and say, off with heads, or we're rewriting the Constitution, or you're all out and we're starting all over. You can only push so far. The pivot now, between 2016 and 2017, is to fiscal policy. Fiscal policy is going to be what governments all over the world try to implement, even with a high political cost. And you're seeing Draghi over in Europe ask for this already. This is what he would say. I'm spending $90 billion a month to buy corporate bonds and government bonds so that banks can get along better. And by the way, look at what European banks are doing over the last 6, 12, 18 months. They're at levels that they were at in 2009, 10, 11, in the worst of not only the global financial crisis, but then as it went overseas to Europe, and Europe was under more stress and strain than at any time in the existence of the EU, and banks in Europe are trading at those same levels. So Draghi is saying, look, I've done what I can do. $90 billion a month is, you know, already bloating my $3.5 trillion balance sheet. What do I do for an encore? Do I make it rounded up? There are limits. There are limits because ultimately you and I are involved in this. We cast a vote, and so does everyone that we know. We cast a vote. It's a credibility vote. What do we want to do with our money? If there's a lack of credibility on Wall Street, we pull our money out of the stock market. If there's a lack of credibility with a bank down the street who you think has made too many loans in a run-up in the real estate market, you pull your money. If there's a lack of credibility with the U.S. government, maybe you don't have a dollar exposure. If there's a lack of credibility with the Hungarian government, you don't have a Hungarian currency exposure. I mean, it's just, you pull your money. That's what you do. It should be very obvious and disconcerting to you that 2016 and 2017 represent a massive transition to forcing your behavior to be changed. It has to be changed. Your expectations of freedom have to be altered. The idea of a market is already being changed because, look, they're controlling the price of money. And by controlling the price of money, guess what they're also doing? They're controlling the prices of stocks. They're controlling the prices of real estate. You're dealing with the cost of capital. Tell me that the cost of capital isn't incredibly relevant to the value of stocks, bonds, real estate, and every other asset on the planet. Cost of capital, it's hyperbole to say everything, but it's almost everything. The cost of capital is very, very important. All of you were in this room when a home mortgage cost 16, 18%, weren't you? Okay. What was the cost of a home? Sticker price. High cost of capital, low sticker price. And what happens when you have a low cost of capital? So we're in a world of inflated values because they've manipulated the cost of capital lower. And we're not concerned that that's a sustainable project. And I think a lot of you have already made the decision to do something about that. Risk has fundamentally been mispriced. You've got the risk-free rate, which is U.S. Treasuries, distorted by our central bank and others, and it's altering asset prices. And of course, it's also altering implicit risks. You've got income-starved investors who've exaggerated that trend, people who expected to have $100,000, $1 million, $10 million creating income for them in retirement. And guess what? At a zero rate or a negative rate, their money's not working for them, which means that income starved as they are, they're moving to equities, they're moving to less quality fixed income assets. And that's exaggerating price trends. It's boosting the bubble dynamics in those other areas as well. The use of ETFs and mutual funds gives the impression of liquidity, which no longer exists. The average investor says, you know, and listen, this galls me. I went to a meeting about mid-January, and I'm a part of a university in Colorado. We help advise on their endowment. I mean, I advise. It's a pro bono thing. I'm not connected to the management at all. It's just they respect my opinion. I don't know if they respect my opinion. They tolerate my opinion. And the guy walks in from UBS and he says, look, we have these great guys back in New York and they've run these computer models and it's worked out really well. This is what we've decided to do. It was just too hard to get in touch with everyone for this approval. And, you know, the board's allowed us a little bit more leeway since November. So here are the changes we made. We sold all of our gold. We sold all of our gold stocks. No offense, Dave, but, you know, there were some bright guys that really thought we should not be in something that's an only losing strategy. And we've bought junk bonds. And I said, how much, did you buy a little bit of junk bonds? I mean, a little bit of anything could be fine. Like, no. This was about 15% of the portfolio. And I didn't say anything because I was just ticked. I was ticked because these are people who don't understand that the vehicle that they chose was an exchange-traded fund with illiquid assets in it. And it's easy to buy, but it's not easy to sell. It's a six-lane freeway going in, and it's a go trail getting out. And they don't have a clue. And the fiduciary responsibility that they have to support the education of future students at Fort Lewis College, I'm thinking, oh my gosh. So, use of ETFs and mutual funds, it does give the impression of liquidity, but that liquidity doesn't exist. So you want a real-time example. How about the six funds that have just been gated in Great Britain? Real estate funds. These are mutual funds in Great Britain, which had liquidity until last week. When the managers of those funds said, well, we actually don't know the value of the underlying asset. So to pretend like we can buy and sell it like it's a stock doesn't really work. So you can't buy it and sell it like a stock anymore. That kind of gating behavior was also common with the Bear funds. I'm talking about Bear Stearns funds just before Bear Stearns went under. There are strange liquidity dynamics both in London and in New York, which suggest to me that there is a lot of stress that people aren't really talking about. Do you want to be in liquid assets? I think you do. Wall Street momentum players, these are the other folks that have been fundamentally mispricing assets, driving prices to extreme levels, using leverage, which we talked about, using margin debt to do that. Highest levels of margin debt in recorded history. Good place to start as a value investor? I think not. Increase in the rate of loan delinquencies. So these are commercial industrial loans. And again, this is not an absolute measure of loan delinquencies. This is a rate of change measurement. So as you see this number accelerate, what it signifies is that you are nearing a recession. Okay. So again, this is not the total volume of loans which are souring. It is the rate of change of loans which are souring in the commercial and industrial space. And you're getting close to that tipping point, a transition, if you will, a 2016 transition to recession. Precious metals, and then we'll close. We had about a 10-year phase where gold was two steps forward, one step back. That would be what I would describe as phase one and phase two of a structural bull market, 2001 to 2011. 2011 to 2015 has been a cyclical bear market. Structural or secular suggests longer term. Cyclical, that just simply means shorter term. So you've got a long-term structural bull market, which I think started in 2001. The first two phases of that are complete, interrupted by a four-year hiatus, a cyclical bear market. And I'll suggest to you that this is really no different than what we saw in 1975 and 1976. We declined 45.6% in the 1970s. We declined about 44% in the decline through December of 2015. In terms of the severity of the decline, it's spot on. It's the number. It's the number. Now, it took 2 years longer, which was probably more testing to anyone's patience. But nevertheless, we haven't diverged from this concept of a structural bull market exists. We just experienced a cyclical bear. 2016 to 2015, I think, is phase three of a structural bull market, which continues and completes. Phase three is the end of any bull market. And it's generally where you see the public participate the most. January marked a transition from the cyclical bear back to a secular bull, and several years of increasing prices, we believe, are in front of us. We expect to take out the 2011 and 12 highs, and over the next several years, we think that we will move even higher. One thing that you need to be aware of, as we looked at the rate of change in this chart, keep in mind that the rate of ascent, the rate of change, is also a very important factor from a technical standpoint for gold. We got to a terminal rate of change with silver when it peaked at about $50 just a few years ago. Gold never got that overheated. Its rate of change was never enough to signal the end of a gold or silver bull market. Silver is just a smaller market and tends to exaggerate whatever trend gold is in. So from a technical standpoint, I would argue that the trend is still in place. The breaking of the lower lows part is what's compelling to me. Unfortunately, I think to be squeezed onto this frame, you don't see, well, this is 2015, so what you're missing is 2016. Sorry about that. The blue trend line, which has been coming down since 2011 and 12, again, where you have lower highs and lower lows, we've broken that trend with higher lows and higher highs. So this is where I think we have some work ahead of us. I don't think we're sort of in the clear yet. But when you have past lower peaks, those kind of become the next levels for upside confirmation. And that's what I've tried to imply here with these lines. So the seven golden steps, we've passed three of them, are on to number four. May see that in the next few weeks. 1192, these are areas that we needed to get above and stay above to represent having real energy or strength to move forward. And yes, there's more work to be done to retake the old highs. But 1192, 1232, 1307, 1392 is the next target, followed by 1433, 1540, and 1800. to break the bear trend, we needed to get above 1232 and 1307 with conviction. We got above 1307 with conviction. By conviction, I mean with good volumes and with the close above those levels for days. Now, the longer you stay above 1307, the more sure your footing is. And the longer you stay above 1392, the more sure your footing is. But you need to look at those numbers and say, okay, well, there is a battle to be fought at, just call it 1400. There's a battle to be fought at 1433. There's a battle to be fought at 1540. It will take time, and these are the areas where you can expect to see consolidation. The price will get there, and it'll feel like a glass ceiling until you break through. And you may be stuck below it for 1 month, 2 months, 2 weeks, 2 days, 6 months. But that's the steps that you need to rise. And I think we are on our way to $8,000 an ounce. I think that's a new target. That's four times the previous high, which would be about 7,600. But I think we'll see new highs within 2 to 3 years. And I think we could see the new and final highs, as in 7,000 to 8,000 an ounce, 7,600 to 8,000 an ounce, within a 5 to 7 year time frame, as quickly as 2020 and maybe just beyond that. Remember that gold represents a barometer for confidence. Confidence in the status quo, confidence in the things that you've always taken for granted, confidence in the stock market rising, confidence in, you know, the election cycle being normal, confidence in normal law versus martial law. Gold represents something that's absolutely unnecessary under normal circumstances. And if things get really unnormal or wacky or unpredictable, then people clamor for what gives them an assurance. It's like Linus in a security blanket. Just keep it close and you feel better about the day. And there's more and more people that want that sense of security. So when you see the price of gold rise, you need to recognize that it is representative of a migration of investors who have, for one reason or another, decided that they shouldn't have the same degree of confidence in the system as they once had. And there's a growing audience. I think you could see some seasonal weakness. I mean, Brexit may have eliminated seasonality, to be quite frank. I mean, ordinarily we would see the low for gold, and you can say that in 25 years, 20 to 22 of those years, the low for gold has been set between June and August. And it's been on a tear. And ordinarily, seasonally, you would see a pullback. I don't know if Brexit eliminates seasonality or not. What you're looking at here is not only the gold price, but also in terms of futures holders, you've got commercials which are at nearly a record short and large speculators which are at a record long position. To be honest, that's not a really good position to be in. The commercials are generally right, and you should see the price of gold drop with that amount of a short position amongst the commercials. The one thing that the commercials can't take into account, because, I mean, again, we're talking about miners who are hedging production and things of this nature, they can't take into account the world falling to pieces and a mad traffic into the gold market. But anytime you pair off large speculators against the commercials will win. So I would expect to see some downside in the gold price. But again, is that downside to 1300? I mentioned this when we did the Q&A next door before we got started tonight, and it's that on every decline in the price since January 1, this is negative, very negative. But I'm going to add a huge caveat to it. In the context of a bull market, it can become irrelevant. And depending on how strong the bull market, it's very irrelevant. In the context of a bear market, this is the most relevant thing that you can look at. If you want to know the direction of gold or silver in the context of a cyclical bear, know where the commercials are. Up or down with the commercials, up or down with the gold price. Okay? But the more you see a shift across a broader base of investors, you can take this relevance and turn it to nothing. Nothing. So that's what I was commenting on next door. We had multiple opportunities for the gold price to decline. It did since January 1. And every time it did drop, $5, $10, $20, massive money was coming into GLD. That is the exchange-traded fund, which offers a good proxy for the price of gold. That's a radical psychological shift, because for the last 5 years, anytime the price is down, that represents an exaggeration of the trend. People are dumping it. It's a liquid position, and you see a lot of extra negative activity in GLD liquidation. Not so. Every dip has been an opportunity to pick it up cheaper. I talked to a couple of hedge fund managers on the East Coast, and they kept on saying, 1250, Dave, 1250, we want to buy gold. We just want to see it close above 1250 and we'll buy. And I called them at 1300 and they said, well, I think we'll see it at 1250. It's funny, the psychology that shifted. They wanted a confirmation on the upside that it had support, but once it had gotten above, they didn't want to pay $1,300. They wanted to wait for it to drop back to $1,250. So even the quote-unquote smartest guys in the room deal with a psychological issue of, has the price gone? Has it left? Could I wait? Should I buy it on a dip? And so what you see is when the price has dipped, it's been bought aggressively. And the tonnage in GLD is quite impressive, what's being taken off the market. There's a few other things that will be a positive impact by the time we get to August. You know, seasonally, August tends to pick up because of the Indian wedding season. I mean, not that you look at these things all the time, but weakness in the rupee is certainly a driver of interest in gold in the Indian market. And of course, heavier rains, a better bounty means that there's bigger gifts to give and there's a lot more gold consumed. So believe it or not, the weather in India impacts whether or not August is a great month or just an okay month. But generally, August and September are at least okay because of the Indian wedding season. So investors there have wanted gold. Investors have turned away from government bonds in the Indian space, and they've just kicked out a pretty legitimate central bank president in India. He was doing some things that ran against the established power and what he thought was in the best interest of India and not the established political parties. And he's out. He's going back to academia. So what are investors wanting right now? They're wanting gold. They're wanting treasuries. They're wanting cash. Let me give you a few things to think about in terms of why we see gold moving to our reconfirmed price target of 5,000 and potentially 8,000 in the fullness of time. A shift in supplies to the east, they are irreversible. The tonnage which came out of GLD in 2012 and 13 and the panic selling of 13 and 14, that was converted from 400-ounce good delivery bars to kilos in Switzerland and shipped to Shanghai and Hong Kong. We won't see it again. So the next time around, as the price begins to rise and U.S. and European investors start buying gold via the ETFs, they're assuming that there's plenty of supply to go around. And so it may seem preposterous to suggest 5,000 to 8,000 an ounce, but you just don't know how thin that market is. You don't know how small the gold market is relative to the global financial market, the currency markets, the bond market, the stock market. And when people want more control, this is where they go. This is where they go. Central bank accumulation continues. Ken Rogoff, ironically, while he's suggesting sort of a gating of the financial system and an imposition of negative rates, is also encouraging your emerging market central banks to accumulate more gold. I'd like to have a conversation with him because I don't fully understand his framework. But there is accumulation of gold by the central banks. That shifted from net negative to net positive in 2009, and it's been positive accumulation since that time frame. Investor demand, that I think is returning, and it always returns under certain circumstances of uncertainty. I hope you've gotten a bit of our view of where the world is and where it's going tonight, but uncertainty is not something that's theoretical at this point. It's all around us. What does Europe look like 2 years from now? What does America look like 2 years from now? What does the Pacific look like 2 years from now? Is it more peaceful? Is it less peaceful? There are certainly issues of uncertainty, and that drives investor demand into cash, out of equities, and into gold too. We have mine supplies, which have peaked and will continue to decline over the next decade, with the worst of those declines being over the next 3 years. So about the time the world is more interested in gold, you've got less supply coming from mines. The last 5 years, I mean, for a speculator or an investor, this is very intriguing because we're at an interesting juncture. You've got miners who have tightened their belts in order to survive. You've got investors who have assumed that all of them would go bankrupt. And so a lot of those shares have been priced for bankruptcy and then, quite frankly, have done quite well since the beginning of the year. Your small miners are up as many as 4 or 5 times, not necessarily my style of investing, that's sort of at the far end of speculation. But even your gold share indexes are up 100 to 150% with a move of 25 to 30% in gold. Currency crises will drive safe haven buying as gold substitutes for cash in all cultures. It always has substituted for cash. I think it always will, unless it's illegal. And that's what people like to put safe haven money in. Safe haven money has been going to two places, government bonds and gold. If you look at those yields, and a lot of them being negative, safe haven money is going into government bonds and gold. And part of the reason I think gold gets a double play in terms of a safe haven asset is there's really no reason for instance, for people to have great confidence in the Italian government. I'm not picking on the Italians. I'm just saying that they have a history of slaughtering their currency, and they're likely to move back to doing the same thing again. So do you want to own Italian government bonds, which over a 10-year period yield you less than 1.5%? I would say that that's a bad bet. But people are lining up to do it, which suggests to me that just as there's a migration into foolhardy investments like that, there'll be a migration out. The derivative market and counterparty concerns, I think that'll drive considerable demand globally. The derivative market has never shrunk considerably in the context of Dodd-Frank. Those risks still exist. All we've done is postpone time. The problems that emerged in 2008 and 2009 are still there. They've just been papered over. They never went away. Structurally, they're still there. I see no confidence in a PhD monetary standard and in our PhD monetary leadership sparking a revolt and a mass exodus out of paper assets, out of cash specifically, into gold. And we're already watching Wall Street take a greater interest in gold since the beginning of the year. The previous high, 2011, Wall Street had about a 2% allocation to the metals. And I think that by the end of the bull market in metals, you'll see it anywhere from 6 to 10%. And I can just tell you, there's not enough space in the gold and silver market unless you're talking about a $5,000 or $10,000 gold price. In the 1970s, we went from $35 an ounce, which was an arbitrary price, set in 1933, set there by edict, and we went to about $190 by 1974. We went into a correction, as I mentioned, about a 46% correction. We settled out at about $105 an ounce. And by the end of 76, we started to move higher. The dollar had stabilized. It wasn't moving lower. It had stabilized by 76, but gold still went up 8 times from 105 to 850. Today, we were technically at a low of 250, but if you said, look, for the duration of the bear market in gold through the 80s and 90s, we averaged right around $350. That's our launching point. We went from 350 to 1900. We corrected back to 1050. Do I think we could see $8,500 an ounce? And my question is this, does it seem unreasonable for gold to reflect a tenfold expansion in global monetary supply? Does it seem unreasonable for gold to reflect a greater than 20-fold expansion in global debt since the 1970s? All we're doing is adding a zero. So do you own enough to matter? That certainly is one follow-on question. And, you know, I have some recommendations. I think that there are transitions that are inescapable here in 2016 and 2017. How well are you going to handle the transitions? That's a very important question. And I want you to know that we can help. We can help with that. Our recommendations for the last several years have been to increase a cash position, limit your equity exposure, make sure that you have sufficient metals in your portfolio to represent a hedge against a variety of outcomes. Bonds, I'm torn because they will continue, like any good Ponzi scheme, they'll continue to make money until the day the Ponzi scheme snaps, and then bonds will be everyone's worst nightmare. So should you own gold in this environment? Clearly. Our wealth management service has navigated some pretty challenging years through a bear market in metals and an unreasonable growth in the equities markets. And I'll say it, I'm ecstatic what's happening in our accounts, and I'm very enthusiastic about what the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years looks like for our wealth management offerings. We have something that I want you to think about, and this is why we actually created our wealth management platform in the first place. Going back to 2005, my dad and I had some conversations about what we would be doing at the end of a bull market in gold. Of course, gold was on the rise, and it continued to for many years after that. So what do we do at the end of a bull market in gold? And his simple answer was, well, we'll sell some of our ounces and do something else. I don't know what greener pastures look like, but it'll be fairly obvious when we get there. And I said, okay, well, how do we do that in such a way that we help facilitate that for other people? Because it seems a matter of integrity. If we are in the process of liquidating our personal ounces, that we convey that to others, that they know you're able to do what you want to do, you're free to do what you want to do. But at some point, the McIlvanys are going to be selling some of their ounces. Do you want to know that? As opposed to buy, 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 buy. I think you want to know that we're selling. And that's what we want to put out there. We've tried to create a venue where you can know what we're thinking in a very candid and open way through the commentary. And it's a way that we can communicate to people instantaneously on a weekly basis to tens or hundreds of thousands. Okay. So we can get in touch with you even if there's not enough time to call every client. If you're listening to the commentary, you know what we're thinking. Okay. And if there's a call to action, certainly that's a venue for us. Why are we doing this? Why do we do what we do? We look at the future the same way you look at the future. You look at your kids, you look at your grandkids, and you want something better for them. You work hard your adult life, and you don't want it to be wasted. You want that work to be appreciated. You want your efforts in life to have counted for something. And so for us to look and say, what we're doing as a company ties to a financial legacy that we want to perpetuate as a family, and we hope that that's important to you too, to be able to sort of navigate the transitions. Now, this transition is years ahead. I think we have 3, 4, 5, maybe longer than that. But I'm talking now about a transition that's far off on the horizon. We have immediate transitions in 2016, which represent either market chaos and volatility or opportunity, depending on what side of the markets you're on. But what we're really about is helping you organize your legacy. If that's the financial legacy, fine. If it's having a conversation about something that's non-financial, I just want to put this on your radar. In October and November, you can get a copy of The Intentional Legacy, which is the title of a book I've been working on for 2 years. And there is a chapter on financial component. The vast majority of the book is about managing resources of a non-financial nature. How, as a parent or grandparent, do you cultivate the life of the mind within your family? How, as a parent or grandparent, do you cultivate healthy spiritual dynamics inside the life of your family? How, as a grandparent or parent, do you cultivate the emotional maturing of your children, of your nephews, of your nieces, of people that you care about? These are resources you have to care about, and you have to be intentional about managing. And yes, when you think about legacy, most people default to, did I leave anything? A house, a 401k, an account balance that would be of value. I'm telling you, you are building a legacy right now. You're building a legacy with every little choice that you make about how you live your life, about the things that you prioritize, about the way you spend your holidays. And so what we do in our business lives is only one narrow strip that hopefully is a complement to what you're already doing and a much larger swath of the cloth. What does the tapestry of your life look like? What does it look like? How well is it woven? What story does it tell? We hope that it is a master narrative. And I hope that November, December, if the book is of interest to you, The Intentional Legacy might clarify or be helpful in some way in terms of providing a resource to talk about with your family members. But what that book expresses is at the heart of our organization. And our organization just wants to convey it's an honor and a privilege to work with you. It's an honor and a privilege to work for you. We feel that we are attached in some way to your financial legacy. We just would want you to know that there's bigger issues than that. And that for all that we've talked about tonight, that may transition of a financial, economic, or political nature, there's much that we need to be prayerful of and thoughtful of as individuals if we want to see the world a better place. And I look forward to ways that we can help you. If there's more ways that we can, or if we never have, and this would be a first opportunity to get to know you, we have an amazing, an absolutely amazing staff. People who've been with us, as Kevin mentioned, 20, 30, almost 40 years, and it's unheard of. We have folks that have an expertise that goes far beyond anything you would find in the industry. Doing business with us, I will tell you, we're certainly not the cheapest in the industry, but what you do get is a permanent team on retainer for you at your beck and call anytime, night or day. If you want a team that has your best interest in mind, if you want a team that cares, frankly, about a lot more than money and other things other than money, but are very careful in our parsing of the details as it relates to how to manage money, maybe we're that team for you. Well, thank you all for joining us. Again, we think that there's some fascinating transitions ahead, not transitions that we're frankly concerned about, because there's some practical things that can be done in advance of sort of experiencing them. And we hope that you'll call us and brainstorm with us ways that we might help you. Crisis equaling opportunity is almost cliche at this point, looking at those old Chinese characters. But you look at the cyclicality of life. We all have good days and bad days. That's just reality. And to try to avoid the bad days, you know, requires external stimulants that can have very negative effects. We're talking about an entire global monetary system, which has been told you can't have any bad days. And so we now have these sort of manic behaviors on the basis of sort of a drug-induced, liquidity-induced stimulus to the economy. It's not healthy. It's not normal. And quite frankly, it's okay to have a bad day. And it's okay for prices to go down. That's what has happened for 5,000 years. We're still here. Prices to go down, you just don't want to be on the wrong side of the equation. So we'd love to see your families flourish in the years, the decades, the generations to come. And I hope that, you know, November, December is the book's out, and that might be a good Christmas present to pass around and discuss the intentional legacy. Thanks for joining us tonight.